on the microphone? They're a little recorder here. Good. Okay. So, kind of starting another Dharma seminar, kind of series of talks that I and maybe some other people will be giving, kind of looking at this book called We Were Made for These Times by Kyra Jewel Lingo. And I'll talk more about that in just a moment. I remember when I first saw the title of this book, I was a little bit startled. We Were Made for These Times. It seems hard to believe. These times are so troubling, and it's so hard to be fully committed and alive, I think, during these times. So I was wondering, when I first saw the book, what she could have meant by this. Do you feel you were made for these times? Climate change crisis and opioid crisis, the wars going on. At any rate, come back to that in a moment, but you know, over the next few weeks, I'd like to consider the writings from this book. And you may remember Kate introduced Kyra Jewel Lingo to the Sangha some weeks back. And we thought it would be good to delve a little more into her writings, into her teachings. So for the next few weeks on Wednesdays, and I'm not sure how many Wednesdays yet, but I thought we would use this book not to go read it together, but to use it as a foundation for discussing Buddhist perspectives on change, loss, and disruption, to use Kyra's own phrase, change, loss, and disruption. Now, some of you may have heard of her, at least from Kate's talk, but I suspect she's unfamiliar to many of us here. So let's begin by, maybe I'll begin by saying a few words about her life, because it's quite interesting. You know, over the years, and now it's almost 70 years for me, I've come to see that every life is unique. And I didn't used to believe that. I thought there was the humdrum life and then other lives. But now I realize that's a wrong view. Yeah, every life is unique, but it is true some lives are more unique than others. I can put it that way. And I think Kyra's life is really quite unique. And I hope I'm not being disrespectful by referring to her first name, Kyra, rather than Lingo, her last name. It's just that I listened to a couple of interviews, and she was always called by her first name. So I hope that's okay. I hope that's what she wants to be called. So Kyra grew up in an interracial family that embraced an ecumenical Christian church, and that church focused on voluntary simplicity and service to the poor. The family lived actually in a residential community. Sounds kind of like a commune. And when she was a child, the family moved to Kenya, where her family was involved in community development for about 4 years. Her father was doing, I forget exactly what, but as a young adult, then Kyra spent a year in Brazil as an exchange student, and later did her master's degree at Stanford University. Anyway, when she was 23, she met the Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, and at 25, she became a nun and lived for the next 15 years or so in monasteries. And then as her practice developed, she started teaching, both in France and then various places around the world. And somehow, during this time, she also studied with various teachers in the Vipassana movement, like Jack Kornfield, etc. And then, if that wasn't enough, in her early 40s, after 15 years of being a nun, she left the monastery. She left the monastic life and took up the challenges of living a lay life. So that's who she is, a little bit of her background. The title of the book, which intrigued me when I first saw that, I found out by quickly flipping to the back and reading the last chapter, comes from a short essay titled Letter to a Young Activist During Troubled Times, written by the Jungian analyst and poet Clarissa Pinkola Estes. Does it ring a bell, anybody? No, probably not. She wrote one of her most famous books, I think it was called Running with Wolves, which maybe ring a bell, but anyway. And the essay begins with the line, "Mis estimados, do not lose heart. We were made for these times." I just skimmed the essay. But it is in that line of, you know, encouraging people who are deeply concerned about the various issues of the world not to despair. So, I think it really is an appropriate title for Kara's book, as she wrote this book to help the readers find freedom and stability, not only when facing personal challenges, but also the challenges and difficulties in the world at large. So, maybe that's enough about an introduction, and I'd like to have tonight look at the first chapter. And the first chapter is called Coming Home. And it begins, "All of us go through times of transition, challenges, and difficulties. We may have faced or will face times of loss, confusion, or heartbreak. When we realize we cannot control the way our life is unfolding, whether in our personal lives or in the world around us. With mindfulness, we can begin to move through these intense, challenging times in ways that do add suffering and difficulty that are already there. We can even learn to open our hearts to the richness and wisdom these times of immense disruption can bring us." I find it interesting that in this first paragraph, she doesn't offer a panacea for our suffering, but a way to move through our suffering without adding to the suffering and difficulty that are already there. In other words, no quick fix. In the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha described the famous teaching of the two arrows. In life, we cannot control the first arrow. The arrow that hits us may be a sudden illness, the loss of a job, an unfair treatment by a person of authority, a natural disaster. It could be anything. But the second arrow is our reaction to the first. And maybe that reaction is despair, anger, resentment, or some other kind of, you know, strong, afflictive emotion. The second arrow, the Buddha taught, is optional. The first arrow arises from various causes and conditions, often beyond our control. But when we learn to release our reaction, say of judgment or anger or self-blame, that we experience a response to the first arrow, the second arrow then becomes avoidable. And this not holds only true for outside afflictions, things that come to us from the outside somehow, But I think also to our own reaction to our own moments of greed, anger, aggression, fear. So what I mean by that, the second arrow is manifest when we turn on ourselves. How could I have done that? How could I have said that? I'm such a schmuck. And we contract. And then we move throughout the day with that feeling, I'm not okay. I'm not okay. I said that terrible thing. I did that hurtful action. Self-recrimination, despair arises. So as she writes, you know, we add to the suffering and difficulty that's already there with this second arrow. In the last sentence of the paragraph, just to read that again, she writes, we can even learn to open our hearts to the richness and wisdom these times of immense disruption can bring us. Well, I thought about that. We've been through an immense disruption of COVID-19. There's been much death, a great tragedy. And I was wondering, okay, Michael, what richness and wisdom has arisen for you? I think this is a really important point for us to reflect on. Not necessarily about COVID-19, but when tragedy hits our life, is there any richness and wisdom there? So at any rate, I was thinking about COVID-19, and I looked up a recent Pew research paper. If you're familiar with Pew, it's a big kind of liberal research institution in the States. Anyway, found out that they had done a survey, basically asked open questions about COVID-19 and its impact to a large group of Americans. And while the negative impacts were, of course, greater, given stronger voice, people also answered they received benefits. So here's a few of the positive impacts that people mentioned. Many mentioned positive influences to their relationships, including being able to spend more time with spouses, children, and family members, because they no longer had to commute to work or go to school. Others pointed to ways in which regular video chats have helped them connect more with distant family than they had in pre-pandemic times. And others, of course, described a slower pace of life, new hobbies, time to get things done around the house, freedom to simply relax. And one of the ones that received a lot of comments was a better balance of life because people no longer needed to commute. When I was teaching at SFU, I had to commute 45 minutes to an hour to get to SFU every day, and then back. So I can appreciate that. Anyway, what richness and wisdom maybe has come from your own disruptions? Anyway, let's go back to the book here. And she writes in a paragraph shortly following, a key step that can help us begin to settle ourselves when we are profoundly unsettled is to come home to ourselves in this moment, whatever is happening. This is one way of speaking about mindfulness or being present, coming home to ourselves. When we bring our mind back to our body, we come home. We could consider this state as our true home. This home inside of us is a home no one can take away, and it cannot be damaged or destroyed. No matter what happens around us, if we can find this home inside of us, we are always safe. What is this home that Kaira talks about. The home that no one can take away from us, and it cannot be damaged or destroyed. Have you found it? Perhaps this is what we have all been striving for, longing for, and unable to find in our family of origin or a group of friends or other communities that we're connected with. But if our practice, our experience on the cushion, has taught us anything, it is that this home is not a place. So here are the words of Hongzhi Zhengzhe, the great Zen teacher in China who lived around the year 1100. And he's one of my favorite of the Chinese ancestors. And this is what he wrote. A person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part, and the mountains appear. The moon sets, the water is cool. Each bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. So in his poetic way, Hongzhi tells us that a person of the way dances or flows with the stream of life, open to its vast boundlessness. Maybe that's home. So please get out your dancing shoes. Put them on. Dance with life. A bit later in her book, Kaira writes, there is nowhere we need to run to, nowhere we need to be, other than right here, in the present moment. And we experience ourselves at home, no longer looking for some refuge outside us in some other place or time. When we touch the truth that all we long for and search after is right here, inside of us. Sometimes that's hard to believe. Inside of us. So how do we do this? How do we find that place of home that is a deep and true refuge? How do we experience ourselves at home? She wrote, if we're not aware of what's happening in the moment because we're caught up in our thoughts or reveries or in the grip of worry or some other strong emotions, it's as if we had left our house. But the beauty of awareness is that we can always return home to ourselves. Our home is always there, waiting for us to come back. And there are numerous ways we can come home to ourselves. And she begins by listing some of them. By being aware of our breath, by being aware of body sensations or body movements, and by connecting with the reality all around us, like the sounds in our environment. And when we come back home in these ways, we are able to take stock and survey the territory of our being, seeing clearly what parts of our inner landscape need more support, where we need to pay more attention. So she gives us some ways to return home, cultivating simple, bare awareness. And this, of course, is an ancient teaching. And again, here I'd just like to quote Hongzhi. Hongzhi wrote, the practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. In other words, just simple Zazen practice. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes or conditions. This empty, wide open mind is subtle and correctly illuminating. Here you can rest and become clean, pure, and lucid, bright and penetrating. You can immediately return, accord, and respond to deal with events. A lovely last line. From this place of a calm, open awareness, we are able to respond to events. So, our Zazen practice, this practice of sitting down, following our breath, is really simply giving ourselves to ourselves. Who you are in the moment, in our Zazen practice, you fully meet and be with, whether you like that person or not. Just there, be with that as you are. There are times when Zazen is delightful, full of well-being, ease, and spacious. And there are times when our heart and mind are stormy. Maybe lightning is flashing, floodwaters rising, wind howling. But even then, the instruction from our ancestors is just to breathe into this body, into the feelings, the thoughts, and then gently exhale. The effort is to return again and again whenever we veer away. When we veer away from the painful, unpleasant feelings and thoughts about ourselves or others, come back. Just be present in your body. Be present when they arise without trying to vanish them or distract ourselves. So again, turning back to the text. It is especially tempting in times of transition and challenge to abandon our homes, to leave our territory in search of answers, perhaps by worrying about what will happen in the future. And this is precisely the moment when we need to return to the present moment, feel our bodies, take good care of ourselves now. Because the future is made of this moment. If we take good care of this moment, even if it is very difficult, we are taking good care of the future. So how do we take care of this moment? Well, you may think, returning to awareness is kind of passive. After all, are we not surrounded by messages to improve, to be more efficient, more effective, have brighter teeth? And, well, it is true that this practice of awareness can slip into a passive, vague, kind of dull state. And maybe you're feeling a little bit dull right now after the heat of the day and late at night. But that's not the practice. That's not the practice that Kiera or Hongjir are talking about. The heart of this practice is presence. Your presence. Dullness is really simply another way of turning away from what's painful or boring. We return many, many times to witnessing the arise of thoughts and sensations and their passing away. But, of course, this awareness, this attention, we do without judgment or evaluation. Just aware. Just aware. And when you find yourself judging, don't judge the judging. just let go. Become intimate. Become intimate with the experience. So this practice that we do on our cushions and off our cushions helps us to settle and be poised, ready to respond to the situation right before us. Because we don't have preconceived notions about how things should be, and anger or disappointment that they're not that way. Kira writes at the end of this chapter, "We just need to be right in this moment, and if we touch it deeply, mind and body united, we will find that we have all we need to meet the present." I've been struck when I've been reading this book how much faith is involved. I see the influence of Thich Nhat Hanh on her writing, her 15 years of living in Thais monasteries in various places. A kind of faith is necessary. Because it's so easy to kind of dismiss. What if I will not have everything I need to meet the present moment? Isn't that one of the kind of constant gnawing feelings we have? Have I prepared enough for my class? Right? Are all my documents there in my briefcase when I walk into the courtroom? Did I or did I not buy enough puppy food? So many things we can worry about. And that stops us from being alive. Stops us from being here in this moment. But not easy to let go of, as we all know. But we can practice. We can practice coming back to this moment, this body, even when we want to escape. Let's try not to escape, but to come back. Here, now. Your life exactly as it is. So thank you for listening. And we've got lots of time for some discussion. And I have a couple, well, basically one thing I'd like to really focus on, but you're welcome to talk about anything in the talk that came up for you. But my question is, what has been your experience of your true home? That sense of really being home. How do you find your way there? Or maybe what supports you in returning home? And if that seems a little bit too vague or you can't think of something right off the bat, just anything that you has resonated for you in this talk. And if nothing has, I'm sorry. Hopefully. So we'll say goodbye to the Sharebook group, and they can get into their thing. And then people who are on Zoom, we'll put you into, how many people do we have there, River, left in Zoom?
Six, seven, eight.
Okay, how about two groups of four? Yeah. And lo and behold, we'll be two groups of four. I'll join a group.